Thanks for listening to Vermont Edition. I'm Rick Zingari, and I just want you to know that we've edited this podcast for brevity, so you hear all the good stuff quicker. Thanks for listening.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. You know it's embarrassing to run into someone you probably should know, but you've completely forgotten who they are. They often seem slightly miffed. You feel bad. We all have that experience now and then, but some people never recognize faces. And I don't mean it in that self-deprecating, oh, I never remember people kind of way. They have an actual condition called prosopagnosia, or face blindness, and the way their brains work, they literally cannot recognize faces. Often they compensate in other ways, figuring out who someone is by hair or clothes or body type or walk. But the face itself is not familiar, even sometimes if it's your child, spouse, or dear friend. Some researchers think as many as 1 in 50 people have this condition, and some very accomplished, quite famous people have acknowledged they're among that number. Former Colorado governor and current presidential candidate John Hickenlooper says he has face blindness. The noted neurologist and author Oliver Sacks, who made a name for himself writing about people with strange neurological conditions, he had prosopagnosia. One of the leading researchers on this condition and its corollaries is our guest today, Brad Duchaine, a professor of psychological and brain sciences at Dartmouth College. We spoke with him about this in 2012, and today we're going to talk more and learn about what advancements have been made in the intervening years. Professor Duchaine, it's such a pleasure to have you back. Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
So I was giving kind of an overview of face blindness, but you're the expert. How would you describe it, and how would you describe what's actually happening in people's brains that they can't recognize faces?
Yeah, so people with face blindness, they have normal low-level vision, so they're seeing the world in the same way that other people are. And their general intellectual abilities are normal, but they just have a really tough time at recognizing facial identity. So that if they were to be at the grocery store and they run into somebody unexpectedly, they're likely to have a really tough time identifying that person.
So and you can – it's not that you can't see the eyes. I mean, as you said, somebody's eyesight works, and it's not that you can't see that they have eyes or see that they have a mouth. It's just that unless there's some distinguishing characteristic that you have sort of made your brain say, oh, my friend Bob has a very prominent nose, that's probably Bob, it's that they, it just doesn't register as familiar.
Yeah, and it's I should be clear. It's not that prosopagnosics never ever recognize a face. Like you said, sometimes if there's a distinctive feature, they're going to be able to recognize that face. And sometimes I had a guy who I worked with when I wrote my dissertation, and he said, you know, when Clinton got into his second term, I felt like I could recognize him pretty well just from his face. So, you know, after thousands of repetitions, he got pretty good with Bill Clinton. But they have a tough time in many situations.
Well, you're also suggesting there that there are different degrees of prosopagnosia. So some people might have real sort of incredible difficulties. Oliver Sacks often talked about this, that, you know, he couldn't recognize his assistant if it was out of context. And they'd worked together for many years. Whereas somebody like the patient that you mentioned, after a couple thousand repetitions, said, I think I've got this one down. So there is sort of a varying degree of the condition.
Absolutely. And you can think about individual differences as existing not just within the prosopagnosic population, but within the population at large. So we tend to think about face recognition ability as a normal distribution. So you've got some people in the low tail who we call prosopagnosics who are really bad with face recognition. And then the great majority of us are, you know, somewhere in the middle. And then you've got the people that you mentioned in the intro to the show, super recognizers, who are in the other tail, who are just extraordinarily good with face recognition.
There are also a couple different ways that you can become prosopagnosic. And one is you're born with it. And then other people develop it through some kind of brain injury. What kinds of injuries do you see where this is a condition, part of the condition?
Yeah. So when people become what we call them acquired prosopagnosics, any sort of brain damage that affects the areas that are important for face processing can lead to acquired prosopagnosia. And the most common areas are the right temporal lobe. So probably 80%, 85% of the people who contact me because they have problems with face recognition due to brain damage, it's a right temporal lobe problem. And sometimes it's a stroke. Sometimes they had a tumor and they had to have that tumor removed. Anything that affects those brain areas can do it.
And people who have that happen probably notice the difference. I mean, if you suddenly can't recognize people and you did before, that's going to be something that you realize, you know, if those parts of your brain are working functionally, that, whoa, something has happened here. But are people who are born with this condition, they're not always aware that they even have it, right? They sort of think, well, this is just how the world works.
Yeah. Our assumption is that our perception of the world is similar to everybody else's. And so it's often quite difficult for people to realize that their face recognition is really a lot worse than others. The guy I mentioned earlier, the guy I wrote my dissertation on, he was a very smart guy. He went to MIT as an undergrad, got his law degree, worked as an electrical engineer. But it wasn't until his mid-40s that he realized that he has problems recognizing faces. He was sitting around watching television with some friends, and there was a shot that was really close up on the face. And he complained about the fact that this show had a lot of close-ups. And he said, I don't know who's who when they're up close on the face. And his friends looked at him like, you know, what are you talking about, Bill? And that's when it started dawning on him that his ability to recognize faces was really different than others. So, yeah, if you – you know, face recognition isn't something we talk about all that often. So it's often difficult for people to pick up. It's similar to color blindness in that sense.
Yeah, I think of it with colors often, you know, in those – or I did especially as a child. Like, does everybody see what I'm seeing? Is what I think is brown the same as what other people think is brown? But, yeah, with faces, you probably just don't realize that other people aren't having this same kind of difficulty, or they just seem to have compensated in some better way than you have.
Yeah, that's right. I'll hear prosopagnosics say, you know, I was watching a movie. This is before they realized they were prosopagnosic. I was watching a movie and they had somebody, there was a crime committed, and then the person was brought in to try to identify the perpetrator in a lineup. And I thought, come on, that's ridiculous. Nobody could do that.
Listeners, is this registering for you? Is something clicking here? Or do you know about your own ability, either with face blindness, or maybe you're one of the super recognizers who can catch people seemingly out of context and know exactly who they are? You look at their face and that face is absolutely familiar to you, even if it's been 15 years, you know who they are. We'd love to know your perspective on this, your questions maybe about what this is and how it works. We're talking about prosopagnosia or face blindness. And you can give us a call. Our number is 800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211. Or send an email to vermontedition@vpr.org. Professor Duchesne, we got an email, a note from Andrew, who says, as someone with the condition and some other disabilities, I was wondering if there is any link between autism or other mental disabilities and prosopagnosia.
That's a great question. In fact, in my notes before I came over here, I jotted down face processing and autism. It's well established now that people with autism are more likely to have difficulties with face processing. Their most pronounced difficulty tends to be difficulties with facial expression recognition, but they can also have a tough time, say, with facial identity, which is what's the characteristic that we see in prosopagnosic. They might have difficulty knowing whether a face is a man or a woman. And so oftentimes in autism, it's a fairly broad problem with face processing.
And it's clear that it's not somehow a misdiagnosis. I mean, people who do have prosopagnosia often say, people just thought I was rude, or that I was a space cadet, or that I, you know, was making it up or lazy, when really I cannot recognize the face. So there might be a chance that somebody could misdiagnose you. But what you've seen from your research is that these actually are connected often.
So, yeah, so there certainly are. There's elevated rates of face processing problems in autism. But your point is a good one in that we hear from lots of parents of children who are prosopagnosic. And a number of those parents have suspected that their children have received autism diagnoses, not because they have the sort of high-level social cognition problems that characterize autism, as well as a number of other characteristics, but simply because they have face processing problems, and that creates difficulties in social interaction for them. And so it's important to try to differentiate between these two, because if somebody has just problems with faces, that's going to be quite different than if they have the broader problems, which you see in autism.
But it looks like as many as one in every 50 people may have this condition to one degree or another. So that's actually pretty common. Why isn't it better known or better researched? Or why don't all of us know, you know, whether we have prosopagnosia or not?
Yeah, I think a lot of it goes to the fact that it was tough for people to notice it. So the first case wasn't published until 1976. And when I say case, I'm talking about developmental prosopagnosia. That's these people who have never suffered any brain damage but have a really tough time recognizing faces. And it really wasn't until the late 90s that we got an inkling – researchers, that is, got an inkling that there are a lot of people out there who have the same sorts of problems that people with acquired prosopagnosia have. And the internet allowed researchers to get in touch with people with developmental prosopagnosia. And so within the last 15, 20 years, we've realized there's a lot of people out there. But I think just this, the difficulty for prosopagnosics themselves to identify their problem is what led it to be poorly known for a long time.
Is it hereditary?
Absolutely. So we see it often running in families. So my colleagues and I went out and tested a family that had 8 people with prosopagnosia in them. And if we do twin studies just in the general population, we see that the great majority of differences in people's ability to recognize faces are due to genetic differences. We can see that because if we look at how similar 2 identical twins are to one another, we see that they're more than twice as similar to one another in their face recognition ability as 2 fraternal twins.
Let's go to the calls. Adam is on the line with us from Enfield, New Hampshire. Hi, Adam. You're on the air.
Hi.
What have you got for us today, Adam?
I was actually surprised when I heard this topic come up. I didn't realize that this was an actual thing because I'm in sales and I see so many faces all the time. And I have this weird thing where, like, everyone looks sort of vaguely familiar to me, but no one actually, like, connects until I have, like, a 2-minute conversation with them. And then I'm like, oh, that's who this person is. So I have a really hard time identifying people just by their faces.
Huh. Adam, how do you compensate for that? I mean, you mentioned you engage them in conversation, so you can sort of pick up those clues from context. But how else do you feel like you compensate?
Typically, I feel like I just sort of fake it till I make it. You know, like if I see somebody that looks vaguely familiar and they sort, I wait until I see them like have that moment of recognition of me. And then I'll be like, hey, how's it going? And we'll start talking. And then it's not until I get, you know, into the conversation that I can sort of pull out little details and be like, oh, that's how I know this person. And just like you were saying, like, I could never imagine picking someone out of a lineup of, like, you know, in TV shows when they say that, like, oh, we need you to see this guy that you saw one time and tell us if he's the murderer. I'm like, I have no idea.
Adam, I'm so glad that this is resonating and that, you know, perhaps you've realized something about yourself that you didn't realize before that was something that you were dealing with. Brad Duchaine, does that sound familiar?
Absolutely, yeah. And it's interesting, Adam, that you're working in sales. You're making it tough on yourself.
Well, Brad, you know, that's what's kind of amazing, too, is when you think about famous people who have acknowledged or realized that they have this condition. I mean, I mentioned Oliver Sacks. He's a noted neurologist and author. But John Hickenlooper, I mean, if you're going to be a politician, a statewide politician, or then run for president, it seems, again, like Adam, knowing who people are and being able to recognize them in that moment and say, oh, you know, how's your wife? How are your kids? Would be an important part of that job. So, I mean, people are still obviously very high functioning, even if they have severe difficulties in recognizing faces.
Yeah, Hickenlooper is a really great story. Not only has he been a really successful politician, he also ran a restaurant and bar.
Another area, and, yeah.
Yeah, and so what he says he does is he just is friendly to just about everybody. And if you meet somebody, maybe they're a stranger, but you know he doesn't know. He treats them the same way as somebody he's familiar with. And he said, you know, I think the world would be a better place if we all just acted the way I do. And I couldn't argue with him.
Jane Goodall as well had prosopagnosia, and it extended to the faces of the chimps that she studied. So she said she often couldn't recognize a chimp if she didn't know this chimp very well by its face. But after a while, other characteristics came through that helped her acknowledge and recognize who they were.
Yeah, Jane Goodall is interesting in that she clearly had to follow the identities of the chimps that she was following. A lot of prosopagnosics do pretty well, let's say, in an office setting where there might be 10 people they have to recognize. And that's a situation that's kind of similar to what Jane was facing. She was following a troop that maybe had 20 different chimps. Well, in those settings, prosopagnosics often do fairly well. You can imagine if you were sitting at your desk and somebody from a 10-person office came up to your desk and their face was covered, you'd still be able to recognize them because you could use their hair, you could use their body shape, you could use their voice. And so I assume that Jane had to rely on these sorts of cues.
Yeah, boy, it's fascinating. And, you know, Adam, our caller, mentioned, too, that often when he approaches people, he waits to see their expression, whether they have that instant of, you know, recognition, and he can help use that to determine how to respond. So most people with prosopagnosia don't have a problem interpreting emotions or the facial expressions. It's just that it doesn't look familiar. Are there people who also can't process what the facial expressions mean?
Yeah. So most prosopagnosics do seem to be fine at reading facial expressions, but there certainly are many who have a tough time. Rates of difficulties with facial expression or, say, figuring out how old somebody is from their face, figuring out the sex of a face. Those rates of difficulties with those sorts of tasks are higher in prosopagnosics. And the guy, back to Bill, the guy I wrote my dissertation on, he couldn't recognize facial identity. He also had difficulty with facial expression. He said, you know, I find my problems with expression much more challenging than my difficulties with identity. He says, because if I'm in a room with somebody, once I know who they are, I've got it. That's not going to change. But expressions are constantly changing, and I'm not able to keep up with those. And so it makes it tough to engage with somebody normally.
Are there other conditions that often seem to go along with face blindness? I mean, we've talked about high rates of autism or higher rates of autism, but there are other sometimes recognition difficulties that people have, like with places or, you know, getting around.
Yeah, absolutely. So one of the most common things is people with prosopagnosia have difficulty at recognizing individual items from with another class. And what I mean by that is imagine you go out to the parking lot and you have to try to find your car. Well, a prosopagnosic is going to have a tougher time recognizing their car than other people. And when I say a prosopagnosic, I should say some prosopagnosics. Some seem to be totally fine with object recognition. Others have problems. And you referred to navigation. Let's say 20 to 25% of prosopagnosics have a tough time at navigating their neighborhood, so just sort of finding their way around. And that's something you also see in people who've acquired their prosopagnosia due to brain damage. Maybe 50% of people who become prosopagnosic due to brain damage have become what we call topographagnosic. They can't find their way around to navigate.
I don't think we talked about that so much 7 years ago when we had you on the show, Professor G. Shane, these sort of associated areas where people often have trouble with recognition. Is that new understanding or new research? Are you sort of delving deeper these days into what else and how this kind of condition affects people?
Yeah, we have a deeper understanding of it. I mean, there were hints before, particularly from behavioral tests. And just those of us who've worked with prosopagnosics have often thought that there were elevated rates of navigational difficulties. But we published a paper last summer in which we looked not just at brain areas that respond especially strongly to faces, but also other what we call category selective areas. So there are areas that respond especially strongly to bodies, other areas that respond especially strongly to places. And what we found is that in a group of 22 prosopagnosics, it wasn't just face areas that weren't showing a typical response to faces. We also saw that place areas don't show a typical response to places, and body areas don't show a typical response to bodies in the group. So what that suggests is a lot of prosopagnosics don't have problems just limited to face processing, but it's a broader effects across these areas that are important for visual recognition.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Today we're learning more about face blindness, prosopagnosia. It's a fascinating neurological condition, and it often comes as a surprise to people who have it when they finally realize this is actually a thing that explains how they see and identify other people. And we're hearing from many of you. Let's go to Peter, who's calling in from Burlington. Hi, Peter. You're on the air.
Hi. My question has to do with this. Due to various family dynamics, I was raised in such a way that I had virtually no contact with groups of children until I was about 5 and a half. And I therefore never had to identify other little kids. There were certainly adults all around, but never little kids. And I wonder, I've got this condition now to some degree. It's not extreme, but I definitely have trouble with faces. And I wonder if there's any, if you know of any correlation between that kind of isolation from groups of children and and Prozapac. You'll see it better.
Peter, thanks for the call. Brad Duchesne, what about that? Interesting question.
Sure. We just say face blindness, Peter, to keep it simple. there's no doubt that children need – or really young children need some exposure to faces to develop normal face processing. So, for example, if somebody's got a cataract when they're born, they have congenital cataracts. And even if that cataract is removed and they get a normal lens functioning, say, by 3 months of age, you're going to see that that person has difficulties with face processing when they're an adult. So there's a critical period there where you need input. We don't have any evidence to suggest that not seeing children's faces during childhood would lead to problems. My guess would have been that seeing adult faces would be sufficient for the system to sort of maintain its ability. But you know, there's a lot we don't know, so I don't want to rule it out.
Yeah, Peter, thanks for the interesting question. Let's go to John in Marlboro. John, hi. How do you intersect with this conversation?
First of all, I want to thank NPR for putting this sort of information out there, because it was a report maybe 3 years ago on hyper-recognizers in the London Underground that led me to realize I have the obverse problem. I called it facial agnosia because I miss your previous conversation. And I suffer from this situation. I didn't even know that I did until I realized if people can hyper-recognize, maybe that explains why when a TV show shows me a dead body, I have no idea who it is. It could be the protagonist's wife. It could be some new character. And knowing that other folks share this problem and that I am different has been extremely helpful, even as an old person.
Oh, John, I'm so glad that it feels helpful to know. I mean, just to have the knowledge and the understanding that something that you feel like you struggle with or that feels different to you from what perhaps your friends and family members experience must be powerful. And Brad Duchesne, is that true? I mean, is there anything people can do once they know that they have face blindness? Or is it really just this sense of, oh, okay, I'm not going nuts. You know, this is really something.
Yeah, many people find it a really great relief when they learn about prosopagnosia. They know that something was wrong, but they couldn't pinpoint what it was. And oftentimes they'll attribute to just general character flaws. Maybe I don't care enough about people. I'm not trying hard enough. And so it's a real relief for them to hear that it's just a little tweak in their visual system, that you know, it's just not working quite right. That's something I call the prosopagnosia epiphany, and it helps them make sense often of a lot of events in their life where they say, now I understand why that happened. When people do realize they're prosopagnosic, at this point we don't have interventions that can sort of turn somebody from a prosopagnosic into somebody with normal face recognition. So usually what prosopagnosics tend to do is they tend to rely on sort of strategies that they can use to recognize people. So they might say, I'm really going to focus on this person's hair and their voice when I meet them, and I'm going to hope that those are going to allow me to recognize them the next time. A number of labs are looking into whether there are interventions that can improve people's face recognition, but so far the results have been modest and a bit disappointing.
Do people who tell you that they sort of go public with it, that they tell acquaintances and even intimates, like, look, I have this thing. I'm probably not going to recognize you if you walk down the street tomorrow or even 10 minutes from now if you come back into a room and I'm not expecting you. I may not recognize you, and it's not that I don't care. Do people acknowledge that and say that to others, and do the others in the public get it?
Yeah. So a lot of prosopagnosics do take that approach, and they let people know, hey, don't be offended. It's nothing personal. I'm just bad with faces. And that often works quite well for them. And I've had some say to me, you know, I say that to people, and if they don't get it or they don't want to listen to me and think I'm just making excuses, well, that's fine. I don't really even want to be friends with that person anyway. So I think it's a good strategy for them to take.
Although you must also then get people who are like, oh yeah, me too, don't worry about it, but who are more on sort of the middle area of the spectrum, who don't really have a severe problem with it. But all of us sometimes have trouble either recognizing someone out of context, or we forget a name and we think that that's the same thing.
Yeah, especially difficulties with names is how a lot of people interpret prosopagnosia when they hear about it for the first time. And you know, just about all of us have a tough time recognizing or remembering people's names.
Okay, so it's not the same thing. If you can't remember somebody's name, that's not the same thing.
Nope, we've all got that problem.
Let's go to Mark calling in from Guilford. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. My question for your guest is about the role of context in facial recognition. And Jane, as you just hinted, that context plays an important role. So, for instance, what about the process of difficulty identifying who somebody is in a different context, whether it's school or work, and then all of a sudden in the grocery store? I'm just curious about whether there's any science that speaks to that intersection between setting processing and facial recognition processing.
Professor Duchesne?
Yeah, the caller is exactly right. I mean, there's no doubt that context sort of sets the scene for us and helps narrow down the number of faces or the set of faces that we're likely to encounter in a particular place. And it's sort of in those places like the grocery store where you can encounter anybody that prosopagnosics really have a tough time, because if it could be any of 1,000 people, you can't narrow it down and just use a feature or two to identify that person. In terms of the science of context, we don't have a real great handle on sort of the processes that allow us to recognize somebody better based on context. But undoubtedly, they're in our brain working.
Let's go to Paul calling in from Bridport. Paul, go right ahead.
Hi, Jane. Hi, Brad. My question is, it has to do with stress. In 2011, I went into the Peace Corps. As Jane may remember, we exchanged a few emails when I was down there. I had a difficult time of it. I was sent in without language. It was a stressful environment in itself and suffering from culture shock, too, as I've learned. And I'm wondering, and I had trouble recognizing my students. It was very embarrassing. It was only the men and not all of them. And so I'm wondering if stress can bring this problem on. Or if it can expose it, if you've already got it and you had it, you know, it was not really evident. If it can increase it, if it's there, and if it can go away later.
Paul, thanks for the question. Nice to hear from you, Brad Duchesne.
Yeah, as you'd expect, I mean, stress can reduce performance with most any ability that you have, and so face processing is as vulnerable to stress as other abilities that we have. I'd be curious. Maybe your caller's gone now, but I was curious where the caller was, because, as many of your listeners probably know, the other race effect is a real thing when it comes to face recognition. We do have a tougher time recognizing faces of people from other races, other ethnicities, than we do with faces that we're familiar with. And so, for example, I created a face memory test that a lot of different labs use. And then a colleague of mine in Beijing created a Chinese version of it. I was pretty close to chance once I got to the difficult point in that test, even though I'm fine when it comes to Caucasian faces. And so it might be part of the difficulties that the caller was having might have been due to just trying to recognize faces from another part of the world.
Paul, you were in the Dominican Republic, right? Do you think that could have been part of it for you?
That's correct. I was in the Dominican Republic. So everybody in my class was, of course, very dark-skinned.
Huh.
And looked quite alike, yeah.
Well, Paul, it's interesting, and Brad Duchesne, really interesting to note that difference. And that goes across races, that people of all different races have trouble recognizing people of other different races?
Yeah, that's right. Although, because of the universality of Western movies, mm-hmm. you tend to see that the Caucasian faces are often recognized better by people of other races just because they've seen so many of them.
Hmm. You know, we've actually, many of us here at VPR in the last couple of days have taken this facial recognition test that you just mentioned, and we can put a link to it up on our show page at vpr.org for people who want to go through it. It takes about 5 minutes, and it's an interesting test. What do you find, Brad Duchesne, when people take this? Because it's just faces, so there's no hair. There's nothing else that you're going to be able to use to identify people. But they're all people that are in the public eye, so there's a chance that you'd recognize them from sort of multiple chances of having seen them, on TV or elsewhere.
Yeah, so that's what we call a famous face test. And when we create those tests, as you said, we spend a lot of time trying to remove identifying features. So we crop the hair out. And when we do that, all of a sudden you realize how important hair is for recognizing people, because these people don't look as familiar any longer. We also remove any sort of giveaway blemishes that people have. And these famous face tests are about as good as we can do at simulating real-world face recognition, because these are faces that people have seen hundreds or maybe even thousands of times. And when we bring somebody into the lab and they tell me they can't recognize Barack Obama, I don't need a whole lot of data to know that person has a tough time recognizing faces.
Hmm. Justine emailed in to say, throughout my life, I have had excellent facial recognition. If I meet someone whom I recognize, I will attempt to compare our timelines and figure out where we've crossed paths. More often than not, we did indeed cross paths. It has become a valuable asset. So Justine might be a super recognizer. And on that topic, let's go to Julian, who's calling in from Montreal. Hi, Julian. Where do you fall? Are you a super recognizer?
Yes, I have that problem that I see somebody and I say I saw the person somewhere and I ask them, oh, were you in this place at this day like 2-3 years ago? And they say, yes, I was there. So I saw this person there. It's like something that I thought, say, maybe I'm crazy or something. But now with the show, I understand, like you say, some people can have a better ability of recognizing, right?
Yeah, Julian, I'm so glad that this is resonating for you on this other end of the spectrum, that maybe you're realizing, oh, I could be a super recognizer. And is that how it works, Professor Duchesne, that people will be able to see somebody no matter where and say, I saw them, I know who this is, you recognize them, and you can in some cases even pinpoint a day, 3, 10 years ago, which is where you saw them before?
Yeah, Julian's experiences are very typical of a super recognizer. They'll see somebody they saw them at the grocery store 5 years before, and then they see them again, and a lot of super recognizers are kind of motivated to figure it out. It sounds like Julian's the same way, so they'll kind of rack their brain and then they'll figure out where it was that they saw that person. And then if they approach that person and tell them that, of course, the person thinks they're a stalker.
Right. It's not necessarily always seen as a great thing, I imagine.
Right. So a lot of super recognizers learn to hold back and just keep it to themselves. But it's really it's pretty amazing. We first learned about these people, there was a lot of media interest in prosopagnosia 13, 14 years ago. And so we started hearing from a lot of people who said, I'm not prosopagnosic. I'm the opposite. And so eventually we decided to put them to the test. And sure enough, they really were fantastic at face recognition. And now London's Metropolitan Police are making use of them. They've got a super recognizer squad that looks at people who were caught on camera committing crimes. And they've had great luck at identifying suspects that way.
Just because these people have run across this suspect at one point somewhere down the line?
Yeah, exactly. So like, for example, during the London riots of 2011, they had all this CCTV footage of people in the midst of riots. But they had their machine vision system try to recognize the people, and they didn't recognize any of them. Then they had some officers who worked in some of the boroughs where some of these people were coming from. And thus were people who were familiar with the faces. There were a few of them. One guy identified something like 160 people from this. So it can really pay off for police if they put these super recognizer powers to work.
You mentioned that when people were first coming in and saying, I'm the opposite of prosopagnosic, I can recognize everybody, that you were like, we'll put you to the test. Was there skepticism? Did you think people were just bragging at first?
Well, and of course, we did have a few people who just seemed to be bragging who weren't all that great. But yeah, we were skeptical. So we had to make our tests a bit more difficult than the ones we normally use. So we added extra items to our face memory test. And when it came to famous face tests, we didn't just use a standard famous face test because we figured they'd ace that. We wanted to get scores for normal participants off ceiling. So we used a test that we called the Before They Were Famous test. And so we would have a photo of John Wayne when he was 12 years old, or Obama when he was 8 years old. And then the super recognizers were really good at those faces, whereas most people just didn't have a chance with those sorts of faces.
Let's go to Tom, who's on the line with us from Milton. Tom, what do you want to know?
Oh, I'm legally blind, so obviously I don't recognize a lot of faces anymore. But on my iPhone, I have software that helps me navigate, and also a new program calling CAI from Microsoft allows me to take a picture of a person and then ask them what their name is and put it in there. So then when I aim my phone at it, it'll tell me who they are. And I was just asking, do you use software, any other new technology to help these people compensate for what they can't recognize?
Interesting question.
Yeah, we're not doing anything in my lab, but there are some engineering labs that are interested in that. And prosopagnosics have, like you did, have just experimented on their own. So, for example, when Google Glasses first came out, there was a lot of interest in the prosopagnosic community in whether these would be a way that they could recognize people. I think most of the people who used it felt like it was a little too obtrusive for them to make common use of it. But it's easy to imagine in the future, technology is going to solve these face recognition difficulties for a lot of these prosopagnosics. We may well all be wearing glasses, you know, 15 years from now, and they won't be obtrusive.
So, Brad, we had you on before about 7 years ago. It was almost exactly 7 years ago. We looked it up. Now, if we have you on again 7 years from now or 17 years from now, what do you hope that you know? What's the next step for you that you're trying to figure out in terms of prosopagnosia?
Yeah, there are lots of things. So one thing we'd like to have is a good handle on what the different types of prosopagnosia are, because it's clear there are different types. So some people are good with facial expression, some are bad. Some are good with scene processing, some are bad. So we'd like to understand what those different types are. We'd like to understand the neural correlates of each of those types, so which brain areas are not functioning normally. And then one of the things that we'd be really excited about, and this is something we've been working at forever and really haven't made much progress, we'd like to identify some of the genes that are leading to prosopagnosia and that also thus play a role in just the development of normal of face recognition machinery in everybody's brains.
Well, I look forward to that conversation and figuring out what it is that you found. So mark your calendar now. We'll talk to you again in, you know, March, about 7 years from now. I appreciate you already scheduling that for us.
Will do. Okay. Thanks a lot, Jane.
Brad Duchaine is a professor of psychological and brain sciences at Dartmouth College.